Support for Central Florida Public Media comes from the Central Florida Community Arts Symphony Orchestra, presenting Celebrate the Season, December 4th and 5th at Northland in Longwood. The country's largest orchestra shares traditional melodies, orchestral showstoppers, and more. Ticket information at cfcarts.com/NPR.
I was so much older then, I'm younger than that now.
I'm Mark Middleton along with Bill Schaefer, and this is Growing Bolder. Our humble mission, folks, is to change the way the world looks at aging. And we do that by simply turning our cameras and pointing our microphones in the direction of men and women who are leading by example.
And Mark, today is a great day because we have plenty of them for you, starting with the ageless and now famous thoroughbred trainer who nearly won the Triple Crown. Also, one of the most amazing centenarians we've ever met. And Mark, we met a bunch of them.
Yeah, we really have. Also today, one of the greatest country music singers of all time, a former Olympic gold medalist turned author, and an amazing woman with no medical background who cured herself of two rare life-threatening genetic disorders after mapping her own genetic code. Actually did that. All that today on Growing Bolder.
All of our guests are fascinating people, but our next guest captured the attention of the world when at the age of 77 he became the oldest trainer in history to win the Kentucky Derby. He followed that up by becoming the oldest trainer in history to win the Preakness.
Almost became the oldest trainer to win the Triple Crown. You know, over the years, his horses have won more than 2,100 races and $38 million in prize money, but he had never trained a horse that ran in the Derby or the Preakness until he won them both with California Chrome. Let's welcome the amazing Art Sherman. Hey, Art, how are you?
Good morning.
We're thrilled to have you on the show. Congratulations, first of all, on winning both the Derby and the Preakness. And I read somewhere where you said winning them would not change you in any way, but it's hard to believe that it hasn't changed your life at least a little. What's it been like for you the last few months?
Taking a lot of pictures with a lot of different people. No, everybody wants to take the picture, you know what I mean? And it has been great. I've done a lot of seminars. And, you know, just trying to help the thoroughbred racing industry. And, you know, I'm all for that. I'm kind of trying to get people interested in the thoroughbred racing, you know, and it's a plus.
You know, everybody's always been excited to have Art Sherman around. I mean, you're a great guy. Everybody knows you. You make friends real easily. But in the back of their minds, they all said, yeah, but at 77 especially, the guy's winning days are probably over. And look what you did. Look what you did. I mean, it's possible for somebody in their late 70s to still soar to success?
Well, I'll tell you. Good horses make good trainers. And I want to tell you something. California Chrome has changed my life quite a bit. You know what I mean? You wait for a lot of years. You know, I've won grade ones and grade twos with different horses over the years, but never had a horse like him. You know what I mean? It's just how they come about, I have no idea. It's just one great long shot that comes up once in a while, and the story behind it is unbelievable. So I'm just thanking my lucky stars that I was there to appreciate all that has happened to us.
You know, the story at every level is indeed unbelievable. And for the few out there who may not understand it, a quick recap if we can. I mean, this is an industry that is driven by billionaires and genetics. And, you know, part of Chrome's appeal is that a couple of guys named Steve Coburn and Perry Martin paid $8,000 for a poor-performing mare. Insiders called them dumbasses when they did that, so they named their entire stable the Dumbass Stables, and then they paid, you know what, $2,300 for a stud fee for another unknown horse, and the result of that is California Chrome, who Art, by all accounts, was unimpressive himself until you started training him. What happened? What did you do for that horse?
Well, it was just, you know, the basic training. I didn't do anything extra special. I just let him develop. You know, as a two-year-old, he was green. He come to me, and we put blinkers on him and got him more focused. You know what I mean? And then when he turned to be a three-year-old, he matured so much more. And it was a great chance, you know, to be able to go forward with him. Yeah.
You know, Art, you're such an interesting guy. You've been in this industry for a long time, and you've seen it all. And especially when California Chrome had that chance to become the first horse since Affirmed in 1978 to win the Triple Crown. You know, it just didn't happen for you in the Belmont. And I heard you talking about how the Triple Crown really isn't set up to be a fair competition. Can you talk a little bit about why you feel that way?
Well, you know, when you have to run in three major stakes in 5 weeks, different tracks and different horses, you have to have a really tough horse. You know, Chrome adapted really well, and you know, the Belmont, he had a little bit of issues. They stepped on his foot and it was bleeding pretty good. You know what I mean? And the rest of the races, we had good clean trips, and the Belmont we didn't. You know, so, you know, racing luck plays a big part, and it doesn't take, you know, the horse only got beat a length and a half for all of it to win the Triple Crown. You know what I mean? I always look back and say, well, you know, with a little bit of racing luck, you know, we could have been one of the few that has made the Triple Crown run, you know. But I'm really happy the way the horse performed, you know. We had a great time. We met a lot of nice people back east. And he's given me quite a thrill, you know. And he won my first $1 million race, which was the Santa Anita Derby. And of course, the Kentucky Derby was $2 million. And the other race, the Preakness, was $1.5 million. So, you know what I mean? When you're running for all these years with the cheaper kind of horses, it's really, you know, it's overwhelming to you to come up with a horse like him.
Folks, we're talking to Art Sherman, who really was the toast of the sports world for much of this past year. He took an unknown horse, California Chrome, as a two-year-old, turned him into, you know, one of the greatest stories in the history of thoroughbred racing. And Art, it really is one of those deals where everybody, whether you were a racing fan or not, became a fan of California Chrome. You know, the story of Seabiscuit comes to mind. In your 7 decades in the business, have you seen another story like California Chrome? Is Seabiscuit as close as it comes?
Well, I would think so. You know, the way that the game is played now, you know, with all the millions of dollars that people put in and they buy their way into the Derby with, you know, when you really think of it, like a guy like Fletcher had 46 horses nominated for the Kentucky Derby. My God, that's unheard of, you know, and yet he's only won it once, and the rest of the other horses that he has, you know, that's how tough I'm trying to say that the race is to try and win, you know, and it is probably one of the toughest races that I've ever witnessed to win. Of course, when I was a kid, we won it with Swap, but he was an extra special horse, too.
And talk about how tough California Chrome's trainer is. I'm talking about a 77-year-old guy, and Art, when people see you, age melts away. They don't think of age. How do you approach that? How do you deal with the prejudices people have against older people, and what do you think this means now for people who are your age and trying to make up their mark in the world?
Well, you know, after you get to be my age, you're a little bit more laid back. You know, you've seen about everything you can. And thoroughbred racing, there is always some new horizons that you never think that you see, but they're there. And it keeps you young, you know. You'll notice that a lot of the thoroughbred trainers live into their 80s and 90s. I have friends, you know, that were old-timers, and, God, I used to just love their stories and just watch them. And used to be my favorite when I rode for 23 years, that I used to have a lot of old-timers that I rode for. And the game keeps you young and gives you something to look forward to. You never know what that young horse is going to be like. And it, it's like getting up in the morning and saying, wow, maybe I'll have another California Chrome. You know, you're trying to get lucky, you know. Yeah.
Hey, quick question from somebody who knows nothing about the game. Now that Chrome has won two legs of the Triple Crown, does that ensure his value as a stud moving forward? Does that trump what was thought to be a mediocre, you know, lineage? Will he get what he deserves because of what he's won?
Well, I would have to think so. He's got the bankroll now too behind his name. You know, he won $3.5 million already, and his future is still, you know, ahead of him. You know, I'm looking forward to seeing him run as a four-year-old, and I think you'll see one of the best handicapped horses in the country. He'll be around like Wise Dan and Pallet's Malice and the horses that are running right now, you know, with keeping him sound and healthy, and I think, you know, the future looks very good.
Mark brought up a good point. When Hollywood gets around to making the California Chrome story, well, which actor do you think is going to play Art Sherman?
I already got him booked. Joe Pesci.
Oh, man, that would be perfect.
Hey, Art, we're just about winding down here. Do you have a takeaway for us? Is there something that, man, you've seen so much in your 77 years. What can we learn from you about how life works and the power of persistence and never giving up?
Well, you know, you just got to be thankful that you're in good health. You know, that's my number one priority. And your family, I've got two sons that are both trainers, you know what I mean? And I've got, just became a great-grandfather, and that was kind of fun. And, you know, as years go back and you look at, you know, when you first started and where you're at now, and, you know, it's kind of overwhelming for me. You know, I'm just thankful that I can do what I have and I'm in good health, you know, and who knows how many years you got left, but I've had a good life. And, you know, I just look forward of continuing and doing what I love to do, you know.
And we look forward to watching it. Folks, he is the great Art Sherman, one of the greatest horse trainers alive, who at 77 years old stunned the world, leading California Chrome to two legs of the Triple Crown. Art, we will continue to look for you on the track, and we'll look for Joe Pesci playing you in the movie. Thanks, buddy. Coming up, he may be the most amazing centenarian we've ever met, and that is saying something. He's next on Growing Bolder.
Stay connected to Growing Bolder for daily doses of hope, inspiration, and possibility. Find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram for our latest stories and motivational pictures. The following interview was recorded before the passing of our guest.
...101-year-old Rosélio Muñez has a quality of life that is enviable at just about any age. He's active, engaged, and enjoys life at 101 more than ever. Rosélio Muñez starts every day exactly the same.
In the morning, I have a shake. And the shake is made of walnuts, soy milk, and fruits. I put in my shake about 6 or 8 fruits every day. I put some liquid and have it in the morning. And that gives me strength for all the day.
Rosélio became a vegetarian when he was in his 60s. That was 40 years ago. Rosélio Muñez is a centenarian.
People that are vegetarian live from 7 to 10 years longer than the rest of the population. This is scientific. So I am one of the privileged.
It's not just his diet that's key to his longevity.
Roselio rides his stationary bike 3 to 6 miles every day, and he likes to take brisk walks. Especially amazing considering he had a complete knee replacement at the age of 92.
There's not a lot of doctors that will replace a joint in a 92-year-old man.
He said, no, you can have it. At your age, it is impossible.
But Dr. Hugh Morris was impressed with Roselio, his attitude, and his overall fitness level.
He is extremely healthy for 92 and intended to continue being healthy. And after a thorough evaluation and determined he was an excellent candidate for a knee replacement, he requested and had that procedure done.
3 months later, Roselio went to Hawaii for vacation, climbed a volcano's lava flow, and sent a picture to Dr. Morris.
And what did the doctor say? I mean,
he was amazed about that.
No one is more amazed at Roselio than his daughter, Millie. She's learned many things from her father, including forgiveness. When Millie was 8, Roselio was nearly killed by a drunk driver in an automobile accident. He recuperated and went to court, where the driver was found guilty and fined. When the man couldn't pay the fine, he was sentenced to jail.
My dad looked at the side and saw his wife. She was pregnant, and he felt very sad for her. So he said, Judge, can I pay his a fee? And the judge said, do you know this man? And he said, no, but I believe he needs to be home with his wife and his child.
The man never contacted Roselio, never said thank you.
But my father forgave him, and he was at peace.
Roselio attends church every week, and he reads the Bible every day.
This is my favorite thing to do. Read and read and read and read and read.
He comes to me and he says, I just read this article. It was so good. And it's just like the most wonderful thing he's ever read. And he'll do that every day.
And that's not all he does every day.
He likes to go into the computer, and he has a list for me in the afternoons when I come home. Guess what I found out today? There is a planet that is made just of diamond. I mean, every day he will tell me new things that I don't know about.
Do you wish you could still drive?
I could drive.
You still drive?
Yep.
You still have a license?
I have my license.
It's obvious that Roselio loves life. He also loves his family.
I love them so much, and they love me too. So we are very together.
And he loves his country.
Do you have a favorite state?
United States.
You like them all?
They're all.
He has a deep appreciation for many of the things that most of us take for granted.
The fresh grass and the drops of rain like a diamond. This is so beautiful to contemplate what the Lord has done in this world.
Roselio Munez is too busy enjoying life to worry about death.
This doesn't belong to me. I want to live as long as the Lord wants me to be here. Because I am ready to die at any time he asks me, you are over. So I am not afraid of the death.
Until then, he's not counting the days, he's appreciating them, one at a time.
Every day is one day for me. And for me, today is the last day. Not tomorrow, because tomorrow is in the future. So I live according to this day. And tomorrow, when I open my eyes, I try to live again the next day. And that's it. And if you live that way, you don't have to worry for nothing in the world.
One of the most incredible people we have met at any age. And Mark, what a blessing that at 101, he is grateful, he is vibrant, he's smart and curious and appreciates every single day he has.
Yeah, I think all we really need, Bill, is the example of what's possible, because there really is nothing unique about Roselio. I mean, he's got a great family. I mean,
make the list of things that lead to longevity: a great family, social engagement, an active mind, a good diet, lack of stress. He's got it all, but it's something we can all aspire to. And, you know, we see so many people over 100 that just sit in wheelchairs and can barely open their eyes. This guy drives himself. He has fun every day.
We have one thing, Mark, that Roselio didn't have, and that's him as a role model to prove that, yes, it is possible.
Coming up, two-time country music vocalist of the year, voted one of the 50 most beautiful people in the world in 1983. Can you guess who it is? That's next.
It's on and on, and on and on, and on and on we go.
Sign up for the Growing Boulder Insider newsletter, delivered to your inbox every week. Be the first to see our latest interviews, stories, and tips for making each day count. Sign up today at growingboulder.com. Miss an episode of Growing Boulder Radio? Subscribe to our podcast and get it on your mobile device. Details at growingboulder.com/podcasts.
I'll be fine when you're gone. I'll just cry all night long. It is untrue, and don't it make my brown eyes blue?
Bill Schaefer and Mark Middleton here. Mark, a little known fact: somebody heard that song and immediately coined the phrase "smooth as butter." That's where it comes from, that song. Did you know?
Is that true? I didn't know that.
I just made that up.
I like it.
Of course, folks, you're listening to Growing Boulder, and our next guest recorded that song, one of the greatest hits in the history of country music. She did it in one take back in 1977. She went on to record 20 number one country hits during the 70s and 80s with 6 albums certified gold. She became the first female artist in country music history to have an album go platinum.
Yeah, and you know, Bill, that is one of those rare songs that sounds as good today.
Man.
You know, it's timeless as it did back then. Now, she's won a Grammy, 2 Country Vocalist of the Year awards. She was the first female country artist to host her own TV special, the first country artist to tour China, and on and on. And her career is now the subject of an exhibit at the Country Music Hall of Fame that showcases her award. Her fashion, her personal memorabilia, and more. It's called Crystal Gayle, When I Dream, and of course, she is the one and only Crystal Gayle. Hey, Crystal, how are you?
Hello, I'm doing great.
Man, we're doing great to have you here. Thank you so much, and what a career you've had, and kudos to the Country Music Hall of Fame for putting together this show. Before we talk about the show, can we talk just a little bit about your career?
Yes.
When you broke in, you were known mostly as Loretta's little sister because Loretta Lynn is, in fact, your sister, 19 years older. Was that a good thing for you, or did you wish you were, you know, kind of trying to do it on your own at first?
Hey, I mean, I was and still am. I love my sister, and I was very proud. So when they said I'm Loretta Lynn's sister, I mean, made me feel good. Yet, of course, it opened doors, but it also closed a lot of doors. But I wouldn't want it any other way.
You know what? One of the stories I think I heard about you, but I'd love to hear it from you yourself because somehow you know how these things on the internet goes, that you were born Brenda Gayle Webb, and that name wasn't going to cut it, huh?
Well, the reason I had to change Brenda was because I was on Decca Records, and that's the same label as Brenda Lee. They didn't want 2 Brendas, so I didn't care what they called me. Could have called me John or Bill. Or, you know, it was just like Loretta saw the name on a Crystal hamburger. You know, in the South, we have the Crystal hamburgers. So she saw that name, and she said, you know, that name's very bright and shiny, and that's what you should be called. And you know, so now I'm named after hamburger.
Folks, we are talking to the one and only Crystal Gayle. And Crystal, you were one of the, if not the first, crossover country stars. You know, maybe not too big of a stretch to say the Taylor Swift of your day. Did country music like and understand the benefit of you finding success on the pop charts, or was that not looked upon highly back then?
It really wasn't looked on great in the sense of, you know, we weren't trying to rub shoulders. I don't think country or the pop. But I received so many letters from people telling me that my music opened them up to country music, and they loved country music. So, you know, I feel like we helped enlarge our audience. And Kenny Rogers is another one. And coming from the pop direction, Olivia Newton-John. I mean, she crossed over into country.
Crystal, you're one of those people, too. Your look is almost as beautiful as your voice, if not more so. And I think one time you were voted one of the 50 most beautiful people in the world. You're still beautiful now in your 60s. I got to ask you, as a guy who's lost all of his, do you still have your hair?
I do still have quite a bit of my hair. I've cut some back. But and I thinned it because it's heavy through the years, and it would cause headaches. But you know, in our family, you know, we are part Cherokee. Our American Indian heritage is very important to us. But I always attribute being able to grow long hair to my Indian heritage.
Well, Crystal Gayle has got this exhibit now in the Country Music Hall of Fame, Crystal Gayle, When I Dream, some really, really priceless stuff in there. I got to ask you, you've got an exhibit in the Country Music Hall of Fame, but you yourself are not yet in it.
What?
Why not? Yeah, that's a no-brainer. What's the problem there?
Well, I'm not going to push them.
Who do we need to call?
You know, I think there is a committee. You know, there's so many deserving artists to actually be in the Hall of Fame, and there's some, you know, that they probably don't have room to put everybody in it, but we love the Hall of Fame. I find nowadays that since country music is changing drastically, that having the Hall of Fame, it can let people come to Nashville and see what really started it all and what it was all about.
So tell us about this exhibit, Crystal. What do you have for people to see?
Oh, we have a little of everything. My very first expensive dress is in there that my mother bought me. I was going to the Academy of Country Music, and she said I had to have a nice dress. So I think it was a little over $100. We got at Lily Rubin. So I hung on to that. It was one of my favorites. And, of course, I've got hand-me-downs from Loretta in there where she would, you know, she didn't wear clothes, so she gave it to us to wear. And just, you know, awards, just personal things that you wouldn't expect to see in there. I made my mother a little cat when in second grade, and she kept it all those years, and I have that in there. You know, when I was going through putting everything together for the exhibit, I was like, wow, I did this. And it's like through the years, you don't really think about what you're doing. But after I got everything together, I said, I'm tired.
And the greatest thing about you, Crystal, is that it's not all in the past. You are still touring. You're still in the studio. And in fact, one of your sons is in the business and in the studio with you as well, right?
My son, Chris, and he went to Belmont. And he is great in the studio. He went into the engineering and to the business part of it. But he also writes and producing his own things. And he's very talented.
And Crystal, through your career, you've seen all kinds of highs, you know, and there's ebbs and flows to everybody's career. What would you say that we can learn? What's the takeaway from Crystal Gayle's life? What can you tell us about life from the cool things you've seen?
Oh, it's always been hard for me to talk about my career, about me being in music. I was someone, and still am, in the way that I never pushed. I never set these huge goals, and people constantly have goals, and they're heading for them. But I was just lucky to have great people around me, wonderful people that make up all these artists that you hear on radio. And I just hope that they come away with loving my music, you know, like, you know, thinking that I did make some good music, and just a good person, really.
I'm in love, Mark.
You know, I am too. You can hear it in her voice. You know,
great lady.
Yeah, still has a passion for life. Very easy to talk to. Crystal Gayle, thank you so much. And folks, if you can make it to the Country Music Hall of Fame, you really should. And check out the special exhibit there, Crystal Gayle, When I Dream, one of the greatest performers in the history
and then
of country music.
Ask the guy standing there why she's not a member.
Yeah, let's make a phone call right now.
Let's start that, Mark.
Let's do that. Hey, Crystal, thanks so much.
Don't it make my brown eyes?
Coming up next, is there a week in your life that's worthy of a book? Well, there is in Jeff Farrell's, and he's finally written it. Inspiration of Olympic Proportion, next on Growing Bolder.
Sign up for the Growing Bolder Insider Newsletter, delivered to your inbox every week. Be the first to see our latest interviews, stories, and tips for making each day count. Sign up today at growingbolder.com. Miss an episode of Growing Bolder Radio? Subscribe to our podcast and get it on your mobile device. Details at growingbolder.com/podcasts.
My guard stood hard when abstract threats to noble to neglect.
Bill Schaefer along with Mark Middleton here on Growing Bolder. I know you're excited about our next guest. He's an Olympic champion, a member of the International Swimming Hall of Fame, and a multi-world record-holding master swimmer.
Yeah, and you know what? He is not done doing cool stuff because he is the author of a new book. It's called My Olympic Story, Rome 1960, that relives a 10-day period in 1960, 10 days that make up one of the most amazing stories in Olympic history. Welcome the fastest over 75-year-old swimmer who has ever graced the planet Earth, author Jeff Farrell. Hey, Jeff, how are you?
Hi, Bill. Thanks very much. I'm fine.
Yeah, we're thrilled to have you. How does it sound to hear you introduced as author instead of just great swimmer now?
Well, it actually makes me quite proud. I'm just delighted that my book is receiving such good reviews, and it doesn't mean it will be an instant bestseller, but I'm happy. It was a challenging and very satisfying couple of years of work.
You know, it's a fabulous read, folks, and let me just help you set it up real quickly so we can get to right to the meat of it. And as I've told you before, Jeff, I was actually in Detroit for the 1960 Olympic trials. I was 10 years old. I came to see you and Steve Clark and Lance Larson and Mike Troy, and little did I or anybody know what was about to unfold, because you had just set the American record. You were the world's fastest sprinter, thought to be a shoe-in for gold in the Olympics. And then just 6 days before the trials, something tragic happened. What happened?
I was staying in a motel with my coach and a couple of swimmers from Yale that we've been training together up in New Haven. And I woke up about 4 o'clock in the morning with a serious stomach pain. Abdominal. I went into the bathroom, passed out, and when I passed out, I woke up the guys in the room, and even Kippeth, who my coach, who was in the room below us, he heard me fall. So when I came back conscious, my coach was there, and he said, "Where does it hurt?" And I pointed, and he said, "Okay, got to get you to the hospital." And he knew that it was an appendix problem because of the pain and the location.
And, Jeff, that was a huge deal because this was your chance to qualify for the team.
Right. This was just about 3 days after I had won a couple of national titles in Toledo, and 6 days before my first 100 race in the Olympic trials. So it was a critical time.
Now, there's so much more to this story, and I don't want to be the one to do this because Mark is the one who told me about what happened with you, Jeff, and he tells it with such reverence and amazement and affection for the selfless act that you did. You know, I'd much rather, Mark, let you talk him through it.
Well, there are a lot of points to it. I mean, you're going to have to read the whole book to find it. But you know, back then, having an appendectomy was not an easy thing. I mean, it was major surgery. You were 6 days from the trial. First of all, Jeff, how long did doctors tell you it was going to take you to recover from this surgery to the extent that you could actually get on a starting block and race?
Well, I remember lying on a gurney or something in the just outside the operating room, and asking my surgeon how long it would be before I would be able to swim. And his immediate response was about 6 weeks. And I don't think that he was thinking about swimming in the same way that I was, although he did know that I was a serious competitive swimmer.
So 6 weeks instead of 6 days. You mentioned your coach, Kippeth. He actually was an expert on anatomy and advised the doctors on how to cut into you. He probably had an idea in mind because the day after the surgery, he suggested you start to move around a little bit. And then the next day, he told you there's actually a pool in the basement of the hospital, right?
That's right. I had, and at that time, although it may have been his plan all along, I don't know, because I never really asked him about this, but given the instructions he gave to the surgeon, and given the speed with which he wanted me to start exercising again, I just can't help but think that he had in mind that I might be able to make a fast comeback.
All right, so I want to advance the story here because we're down to the last couple of minutes, and I want to get kind of to the takeaway of this thing here. So while this is going on, you don't think you can swim. The doctors tell you you can't swim. The U.S. Olympic Committee is meeting passionately to try to figure out a way they can essentially break the rules so that Jeff Farrell can swim in the Olympics. They offer you a time trial weeks later after you've recovered, whereby if you can beat a particular time from the Olympic trials, they'll let you swim in the Olympics, and you tell them, thanks, but no thanks, right?
That's right. The time trial that they were offering would have taken place, I think, just under 2 weeks from that day when it was the last time that they could tell the Olympic organizers who was going to be competing. They would have had me race against the sixth fastest qualifier for the relay. And for a couple of reasons, I rejected it. The first time, I had to think about it a little bit. The second time they came back a few days later, I rejected it out of hand because, one, it's not wouldn't be fair to the sixth fastest swimmer who made the team at the trials to lose his spot on the team a week or 10 days later. And also, I really wanted to swim in the 100, and I would not have been able to swim in the 100 if I had not gotten that place at the trials in Detroit in the 100.
So essentially, you say no to what would have been a free pass because you say, I'm going to swim. And folks, he did. 6 days after this acute appendicitis, his torso wrapped in surgical bandages, unable to do a proper dive, unable to do a proper turn. He races in both the 100 and the 200, does not get the first or second qualifying space, although he should have gotten both of them had he been healthy. But he performed well enough to go to Rome and swim on both Olympics, where he anchored both the 400 and the 800-meter freestyle relays, two world records. And, Jeff, your splits on both of those relays would have won the gold. Is that right?
That's right. Of course, splits don't count. But, yes, I was – even in Rome, I was the fastest swimmer there.
Well, you know what? I hate to take so much of the story from you, but we are running out of time, and I really want to encourage people to get your book. It's called My Olympic Story, Rome 1960. And folks, not only does it detail these amazing 10 days, it really is almost a historical look at the golden age of swimming because Jeff continues to dip back into the backstory, brings up the biggest names in the sport, the biggest races in the sport. It's a fascinating read. And Jeff, how can people get a hold of a copy?
They can get it on Amazon. They can look me up at Vintage Team Press and buy it directly from me, Vintage Team Press. And it's going to be in local bookstores, I hope. I just got a very good review from Kirkus Reviews, and I'm hopeful it's going to get in a lot of bookstores in the country.
That's great. And our mutual friend Rowdy Gaines loved it as well. Jeff Farrell, thank you so much. Look forward to talking to you again. Coming up, we swim in a sea of inspirational stories, but this one had even us scratching our heads and wondering, how is it possible? That's next on Growing Bolder. We've got news. Watch.GrowingBolder.com, the world's first streaming site for active adults, is now live.
Growing Boulder TV shows, national specials, documentaries, and inspiring videos on ordinary people living extraordinary lives 24/7 on demand for free. Watch.growingboulder.com is now live.
If you're listening to your radio saying to yourself, wow, what an awesome show. That's because you're listening to Growing Boulder. I'm Bill Schaefer with Mark Middleton. With the right kind of care and support and the right attitude, it's possible to not only survive life's greatest challenges, but to thrive in the aftermath.
You know, this story really is one of the most amazing we've heard ever. Kim Goodsell started noticing physical ailments about 20 years ago when she was in her 30s. She was training for an Ironman triathlon. Eventually, she was diagnosed with two rare, very serious diseases that all of the top doctors in the country told her were not connected. It was simply bad luck. And that's where this story does get even more unusual. Let's find out more as we welcome Kim Goodsell. Hey, Kim, how are you?
Very good, thank you.
All right, let's get right to it. You were first diagnosed with a heart condition, had a defibrillator implanted. Years later, diagnosed with a rare and progressive degenerative muscle disease. Your doctor said that the two were not related, and you did not believe that, did you?
No, I didn't. I actually wasn't told they weren't related. It was just completely disregarded when I had my neurology consult. And I went back and I read the record and I looked at his clinical notes, and there was no mention whatsoever, although, you know, I had been diagnosed with a rare cardiomyopathy for 7 years at that point. And there was no mention of that in his summary, his clinic summary. And I thought, wow, that's really strange. How could they not be related? I've got two extremely rare diseases, and the body's a system. It's got to be connected, and that's kind of what made me delve into the research.
And when you delved in head first, didn't you? You Googled, you read, you researched, you found, you believed that a single gene was causing both issues, LMNA. What is all that?
Well, that's a particular gene. As you know, we've got close to 25,000 genes. And what kind of gave me the entry into looking at the different genes was that, you know, now all of a sudden, I knew ARVC, which is my cardiomyopathy, was associated with a genetic disposition. But I thought, you know, that it's not connected with the neurological aspect, and so this is something different. So it provided kind of a narrowing down. So I went and I looked at that particular disease, the nerve disease that I had, and it's associated with 40 different genes that are known to be associated with it. And I just started looking at each and every one of those genes and what kind of symptoms, when you have a mutation in that gene, what kind of symptoms do they produce. And lo and behold, I found one, which is the LMNA, that kind of was an umbrella over all my symptoms. And it even included the cardiomyopathy, although it wasn't under the particular diagnosis that I had. But it was often a cardiomyopathy that's often mistaken for the one that I have. So I thought, well, maybe I've been misdiagnosed all these years, and I have a different kind of cardiomyopathy. So I, you know, that was enough to make me place my bets and have that particular gene sequenced.
Folks, are you getting the idea? This is not your normal patient. She's not a doctor. She's not a researcher. She is just someone that is curious. And obviously, we're never more curious than when our own life is on the line. She did private genomic testing. She became a genetic researcher. And what she found out was, in fact, that there was a link between these two conditions. And that enabled you then to figure out how you could cure them, correct?
Well, you know, I can't cure it because it is a genetic mutation and it's congenital, but I certainly have been wildly successful at managing it. And, you know, with scientific evidence, I've developed a strategy that has worked, and it's not only attenuated or slowed down my neurological debilitation, but it's actually reversed it. And so today, in 2010, I had to use a walker. Today I'm running on the beach and I'm kiteboarding and, you know, holding a lot of power out of a kite and sailing, and so I'm back to pretty much normal, but I definitely have, you know, challenges, and I have to be very strict on a diet. But the point is that through the information, you know, information is power, and information about the self is self-empowerment. And I think we can, you know, what is really important, I think, for all your listeners, and how what I really feel is that it's not so much that I did something extraordinary. I'll admit, and I fight this a lot, because I'm very often dismissed as an outlier, you know, somebody who is doing something extraordinary. And although that's maybe personally empowering, I find it very socially disempowering, because what I did is accessible for everybody today. We are living in a digital information age, and there's a democratization of information. And whatever symptoms you have, you can get on the internet and you can delve into any level that you want to. And we have so many tools at our disposal to, you know, really seize that moment and seize that opportunity and discover ourselves.
But Kim, you've got to get your doctors to work with you. And I would guess that there are probably just as many that love you and others that would say they hate you for doing all this research. Leave it up to us.
Well, and you know, that's really what I'm doing today. I'm really trying to bring the industry, the physicians, the regulatory system, the policy leaders, bring the voice of the patient to these people who are curating the outcomes of this whole digital revolution that's occurring in medicine. And what's happening is the patient is gaining control, or at least the ability to gain control. And they're gaining the tools to drive their health care. And it's in a watershed moment in medicine. And of course there is pushback, because the old school, you know, there's a paternalism that exists in our relationships with our medical health care providers, and we need to partner up with them. And that will take the patient, and it will also take the physicians to, you know, accept that as a reality today, because we as a patient are in the best possible position to assess all of our nuances, you know, all those symptoms. They have 10 minutes to look at you. You know, they can't possibly spend the time that you could researching your own condition. And with their partner, with a partnership, with a collaboration with your physician, you can go so far. I mean, I worked with Mayo physicians, and they were great partners, and they gave me all the information I needed. I had information about my lab tests, every clinical, you know, result and summary that was written about me, and I just combed through it, and I spent a lot of time connecting the dots, but I had the time. I couldn't expect, you know, my physicians to have that kind of engagement that I have.
Well, folks, it is a valuable lesson, and we do have to caution, Kim, and I know you agree with this, there is a lot of very pertinent, salient, important information on the internet. There is also some misinformation, so folks, you have to be careful, but the point is you do have the ability to do research, to interpret your own symptoms, ask some tough questions, ultimately take a very active part in your own health care. She is Kim Goodsell. Kim, congratulations, and please keep up the great work.
Well, we hope we help motivate you even just a little bit to realize it is never too late to get off the couch and get into life.
Bill, what do you say we leave them with a takeaway? And today's comes from Sir Isaac Newton. His first law of motion, commonly known as the law of inertia, says, and we're paraphrasing just a little here, folks, that an object at rest tends to stay at rest, and an object in motion tends to stay in motion. Now, of course, Newton wasn't talking about people, but it does fit. In fact, we're making it Growing Bolder first law of vitality. A person at rest tends to stay at rest, and a person in motion tends to stay in motion. So get moving and get some Growing Bolder inertia in your life. We'll see you next time.
The Growing Bolder Radio Show is a production of Growing Bolder LLC, all rights reserved. This program was recorded at Growing Bolder Studios in Orlando and is available as a weekly podcast on NPR One, iTunes, Spotify, and TuneIn. It is written and produced by Jill Middleton, Mark Middleton, and Bill Schaefer. Technical director is Jason Morrow, Production manager is Michael Nanis, and our most important team member, you. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram to keep growing bolder every day.
Crimson flames tied through my ears, growing high and mighty trapped. Countless fire and flaming road, using ideas as my maps. We'll meet on edges soon, said I.
So much older than I'm younger than that now.
Half right prejudice leap for rip down all hate I scream. Lies that life is black and white spoke from my skull I dream. Romantic flanks of musketeers foundation deep.
So much older than I'm younger than that now.
In a soldier's stance, I aim my hand at the mongrel dogs who teach. Fearing not, I've become my enemy in the instant.